Support for WPR comes from Wills on behalf of Wisconsin Public Libraries, offering access to ebooks, audiobooks, digital magazines, and more. Available with a Wisconsin Library Card at wisconsinsdigitallibrary.org.
Support for WPR comes from Stoughton Health, an independent community healthcare organization, treating acute mental health disorders in adults age 55 and over, accepting many insurance plans. StoughtonHealth.com.
Going to find out now what's going on in the world of wildlife around the state with Scott Craven, UW Extension wildlife ecologist. Thanks for tuning in. And Scott, thank you for coming by. Always a pleasure.
Well, I wish it wasn't so darn hot, but I'm happy to be here, even with the heat.
I tell you what, that heat, how's that heat affected our wildlife? Has it had much impact, do you think?
So far, it probably hasn't made a great deal of difference, except from the standpoint of drying up a lot of wetlands. As I mentioned when we were getting ready for the program, I was out at dawn this morning looking for some helgramites in my favorite wetlands to go perch fishing with, and they just weren't there. Not the helgramites, the wetlands weren't there.
Yeah, the
it was
wetlands.
Just plain dried up. So from the standpoint of larval frogs and salamanders and so forth trying to survive this drying and metamorphose and head out into the uplands, it's going to be a tough go for them again. And, you know, this is the same kind of thing we had a few years ago. And for a while, quite a few frog populations really took a hit. In addition, if it doesn't break soon and soften up the ground a little bit as we get toward the end of the month, and hatchling turtles are trying to emerge, they're not going to get through that sun-baked ground. So they're either not going to make it or they're going to have to try and overwinter in nests, which they sometimes do successfully. But I think the reptiles and amphibians are probably at most risk. The birds in my backyard are certainly very interested in the bird bath and a little bit of water because there isn't much around. But I think as far as most other species, we're still okay.
We have three bird baths in our back lawn, and they all get plenty of use.
Not to mention Lake Monona.
Yeah, and we have Lake Monona, but they're in the bird baths anyway. Yeah. Say, you spent a lot of time here over the last year or so in northern Wisconsin. Any reflections on your work up there?
Well, it was great being back at Kemp Station for a year, or at least as much time as I could spend there with my duties here in Madison. But that's a terrific university facility in the North Woods, headquarters for natural resources research of all types and a lot of educational programs. So I enjoyed being part of that, but I just enjoyed being part of the North Woods community, too. The pace of life, attitudes, and so forth are quite different than what you see in Madison. I forget the expression that Madison is an island or something surrounded by the rest of the reality, but the climate, the topography, the lakes, the fishing and hunting opportunities, the people, opportunities, you know, just to go out. Certainly there are probably more restaurants in Madison than anywhere else, but you get favorite places out in the countryside, and it was just a great experience, so we're looking forward to getting back.
Tell you what, let's go to the phones here. By the way, if you'd like to join in, the number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And by the way, you can also email us at talk@wpr.org. Frank in Arborvita.
Oh, good day, gentlemen.
Hello, thanks for calling.
It's a gorgeous day on Trout Lake today.
Well, that's good to hear.
Well, thanks for rubbing it in, Frank.
Sorry, Scott.
That's okay.
A couple of weeks ago, I made a photo of a mother merganser and her group of little ones.
Mm-hmm.
And I counted 46 twice, 42 once, 48 once, and my daughter, looking very carefully at the picture, thinks there's 52 in there. Now, I'll send you that picture if you'd like to see it. But how in the world, I mean, I know about dump nests, but this is ridiculous. Approximately 50 babies?
Well, I don't think that those probably all hatched from the same nest or from that particular female that you saw. But with some waterfowl, especially with geese, but obviously with mergansers as well, I have a situation where on a given body of water, a number of nests hatch at roughly the same time, and all of a sudden what are called gang broods form. So that mother merganser might have normally had 10 or even a dozen of her own, but if she was in fact an older, more experienced bird or something befell a couple of the other females, whatever, it's not uncommon for the broods to aggregate into this large flock or group that you saw referred to as a gang brood, although whether it was 40 or 50 doesn't really matter. That's still a huge gang brood for that one merganser to be dealing with.
Yeah, they went by yesterday, and they're pretty darn active now, I'll tell you.
Well, hopefully they'll do fine, but that's an aggregation of a number of different broods, probably hatched by different females.
Yep. Thanks for calling, Frank. Okay. Appreciate it very much. And that sort of reminds me that if you look at duck numbers, cans, redheads, shovelers, those numbers are up.
Yes, it looks like it's going to be a very good fall for waterfowl. Canada goose numbers are up, so they're talking about a pretty liberal hunting season for Canada geese here in Wisconsin and elsewhere. And while some duck numbers, like the ones you mentioned, particularly for species that a few years ago were very concerned about, hunting seasons were closed on canvasbacks and redheads, and they were few in number, now they're doing very well. And some of the species that were formerly very abundant, like the bluebills, collectively the scop and ringnecks and pintails, are doing very poorly. So it's sort of like fish in the lake, Larry. You know, it might be a good year for crappies and bluegills one year and perch the next, and then a big year class of walleyes comes along. It's kind of like that with the waterfowl. But overall, it does look like a very good year. And the season structures and bag limits and so forth across the country should be very favorable for waterfowl hunters.
Let's go to Sandy in Wausau next. Sandy, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
See, I just wanted to share an experience that I had a couple of weeks ago about a jelly feeder that the orioles feed out of.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I had a baby get stuck in one.
Hmm.
And it was really sad. He lived, but I managed to pull him out, and he was all goopy. I mean, he had jelly from head to toe. He was just pathetic. But I got him and ran him under some water and had him for like 2 hours, and it finally got all the jelly off of him with the Q-tips under the wings, and I just nursed him like that. And I just wanted to share with everyone to keep the jelly feeders totally filled so that the babies can't get down in there and get stuck. Because it was really sad to pull him out of there and see him all goopy.
Oh. This was a baby oriole.
Yes, a baby oriole.
Hmm. Well, that is unfortunate. I think in addition to trying to keep them full, which is not easy, I know Larry has very active feeders, and I have when I'm home. You know, they can empty them virtually in the time you're at work.
Yes.
So that's not easy. So the other option is to either keep the jelly repository shallow enough so that's not going to be a problem.
Yeah, well, I just used the 10-ounce jar. And
whoa, that's huge.
He fell right in there and got himself worked around in there, and I pulled him out by his tail.
I think that's way too big. Mostly what I see is something from, say, shot glass size up that isn't any more than...
it's about a coffee inch, small coffee
cup. Said use a 10-ounce jar. So and that's what I did, not knowing, you know.
No, that's not a good idea.
In a platform.
I think that's a little large, and if you were going to use something like that, I think it would require some type of a guard maybe halfway down, some sort of crossed sticks or rubber bands or something so the birds simply couldn't get down in there.
You'd want to, I'd really highly recommend that you go to something a little bit smaller than a coffee, you know, a standard size coffee cup. That's what we use.
If you go to a craft store and all these little glass votive candle holders, the short little candles, they come in all sizes. Well, not all sizes, but shapes. And those have worked. I have a couple that are shaped kind of like a little plant pot, so they're wider at the top and narrow at the bottom.
That's what mine are.
And it actually works very well. So I think you need to go with.
He made it, so it took him a couple hours to fly, but he flew, and now he comes back.
Well, all's well that ends well, then.
He sits on my deck and looks in the window.
Good for you. Thanks, Andy.
Okay, thank you.
That's an interesting story. I hadn't heard of anybody using something that large to feed. And a good lesson learned there. Phil in Hebron, Illinois, it's your turn. Hi, Phil.
Good hot morning to you, gentlemen.
Yeah, to you as well.
On hot days like this, Scott, I have red-tailed hawks that are slightly more common than cardinals in this area. And very often, a number of the birds will achieve a pretty high altitude in the heat, and one of the lower birds that's close enough that I can recognize tail feathers will continually call. Do you have any idea why he's doing that, he or her?
I have no idea, Phil.
It's only one bird that will call. Of course, I can't. It's from one area because usually the one bird will be further east and the other ones will be drifting west as in the hot weather. And that one bird will call, and they will do that for 20 minutes straight.
Well, it may be the bird that seems to be separated by some distance from the rest of the pack that's calling. It may be a young bird calling back to the rest of the family group. I really don't know. Anything would be speculation, but...
What are the size of the young now of the hawks, the red tails? Would they
They should be fledged and flying and
out of the
looking
nest.
Pretty good, yeah.
Yeah.
Will those hawks also, will they take young birds? Because I have a lot of young birds that really work on them, and it seems like they must be working on somebody's offspring.
Oh, you mean the blackbirds and things that are attacking
just,
the red tails?
Any kind of bird under the sun is chasing them around usually.
That's simply common behavior, whether that individual bird is being harassed or not. They perceive the hawk as a potential threat and go after it. In fact, on last month's program, we talked about that. Remember that interesting observation, Larry, where the kingbird actually landed on the back of the red tail
right.
and made a complete lap around the golf course, yeah. hanging onto the back of the red tail. So,
are they actually a threat, or is it more just perceived?
There's certainly a bit of a threat. You know, a fledgling bird that's out hopping around on the ground that can't fly is certainly a target for a red tail, but the way they hunt and so forth, they're probably not as much of a threat to actually enter a nest, for example, and snag eggs or nestlings as crows and a variety of other birds. But certainly a young bird out hopping around where it's in the open and spotted by a red tail is potential prey.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Jerry in Dakota, Minnesota. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. How are you guys doing today?
Great. Thank you.
Okay. I was just wondering... if you're a guest or you have heard or seen squirrels eating aluminum, isn't that crazy? I had some aluminum service wire, you know, a service coming in from an electrical pole,
mm-hmm.
and the dang thing, this one, actually, I suppose several of them, I saw it several times, I don't know which squirrel it was, but it was eating the dang aluminum, let's see, support cable. Well, the whole thing was aluminum, you know, rubber covered on the hot wire and that. But this was he didn't bother with the rubber. He just went for the aluminum
wire.
Part, the support part. And I looked for the I just had some the wire wound around a swing, you know, that you swing on, mm-hmm. and just had it rolled over that, and this thing was eating on it, and I looked for the aluminum chips on the ground, and I've had none.
Well, first of all, aluminum's a relatively soft metal, so the squirrels may have figured out that was something easily gnawed on. I've seen squirrels and other rodents, or heard of squirrels or other rodents, gnawing on just about any material you can think of, up to concrete, but most of that behavior is not related to a culinary interest in aluminum, but rather the fact that their incisor teeth, those big paired choppers in the front, are growing constantly, and they're, as a result, constantly gnawing on something, even when they're not eating, in order to keep those teeth worn down so that they mesh properly and remain sharp. So it's most likely that that's what they're doing, but that the
thing is, that damn thing swallowed it. Had to swallow it because I couldn't find any, you know, any of the shavings or bitings or whatever you want to call it. You know?
Yeah, it's hard to tell what size pieces or material they're actually removing there and where it's falling and so forth. So they may actually ingest some of it, but I assume it just passes right through.
Yeah. All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Jerry. Appreciate it. We'll take some more calls. You can join us at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison at 263-1890. I'm Larry Mueller. Jim Packard, our producer here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking the world of wildlife today with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Scott, as we look at some of the funding issues, before we go back to the phones here, I know the Department of Natural Resources has had to cut back on its CWD work a bit.
Well, yes, and that's true, and it's most unfortunate. I think, as most of the listeners realize, chronic wasting disease, or CWD, is a big threat to wildlife management in the state, maybe the biggest one we've ever had. Of course, VHS on the fish side is now a big deal, but the fight against CWD to try and contain or eradicate it has been a difficult 5-year struggle for the DNR, and I think somewhat weak public support has forced them to fight this battle with one hand tied behind their back. Now, if these budget cuts materialize on both the federal side and some state funds, they're looking at about a 60% reduction in their available CWD funding, which would put them into the battle, in my opinion, with both hands tied behind their back. So it's going to be tough. It'll mean that some of the programs that hunters in those CWD management areas have come to be familiar with, like the donation program of deer that are unwanted into the food pantry system, that's threatened with elimination. The sharpshooter program, which to admittedly has been controversial, but it has taken quite a few deer and especially quite a few sick deer out of that area, would also be eliminated, and testing of the animals would be greatly reduced and restricted to the management areas rather than outstate. So it's a big cutback all the way around.
Yeah. Arlene in New Berlin, your turn. Hi, Arlene.
Good morning. I'm certainly enjoying your program and your guests, too. The question I have is, I bought a Oreo feeder. It has from Wild Birds Unlimited, because I usually buy my bird seed from them. It has a little dish that's probably no bigger than 2 inches around deep, and it sits in a hole for Oreos. Mm-hmm. And then we also have another feeder that's kind of flat that I think you put the liquid in for the what you call. What is the proper food for them now at this time of the year? And also the other question is, what do you have a title of a good book that my husband and I can purchase so that we know what to feed these birds at certain times of the year? Because I think during the summertime you feed the Oreos like those worms or whatever it is that they have at the store, and then during the fall they have something else that they feed them.
Well, first of all, the feeder that you describe is fine, and Orioles will be attracted to a sugar water mix, much like hummingbirds.
Mm-hmm.
But most people do very well with only two things, a half an orange to attract them.
Yes, that's what I do.
That's very visible, and that will bring them in. And then the grape jelly feeder is very, very popular. And
yes, that's what I put in that little dish.
Right.
But lately they haven't been coming, and I don't understand why.
That's because it's late in the season.
Oh.
The young have fledged. There's plenty of food out there for most birds. This is not a time of year where most birds are suffering for foodstuffs.
Uh-huh.
And the orioles, along with a lot of the insect-eating birds, will be clearing out before too long. In fact, the swallows and some of the blackbirds are already starting to gather up in early August.
Mm-hmm.
And then they'll be out of here. So I guess I wouldn't be overly concerned. Certainly you want to see them around to the extent that you can.
Yes.
But the food issue now is not nearly as important as it was more early in the year, and they're just not responsive to the jelly. Usually by now, I've quit with the jelly feeding. I don't know if you still have it out, Larry.
No.
I know I went, it was funny because about a week or so I didn't have any activity at all. I thought, okay, I'll take it down. Well, then, a day later, I'm looking out there and there's like three Orioles and they just sort of drained it. I don't know how many other, there usually are six around my feeder, and they emptied it. So then I filled it back up again, and now it's been, several days and it doesn't look like it's been touched.
Yeah, I think the season's really winding down, so I wouldn't be overly concerned. And in answer to your question about the book, if you're dealing with the vendor that you mentioned where you got your feeder,
mm-hmm.
they've got every book under the sun on this topic. But an easy one to get a hold of from any Wisconsin County Extension office is our Extension booklet entitled Bird Feeding, Tips for Beginners and Veterans. And it talks about food preference and timing and a whole host of other things. And as interestingly enough, I just talked to the publication office this morning, and the revision and updating and kind of upgrading in terms of illustration and so forth of that longstanding popular publication is just about done. And I would guess by September that may be on the shelves again. So that's one I would recommend. But if you go to any nature section of a good bookstore now, or any of the wildlife specific stores like Wild Birds Unlimited that you mentioned, mm-hmm. or any of the others, there'll be plenty of books to choose from on that topic.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Arlene. I want to give Richard a chance to get in here from Taylor County. Richard, hi.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
Good.
Hey, I got a question. I'm a mail carrier out here, and I seen a sow cross, a black bear sow with four cubs. I thought that was kind of unusual. I just wondered what you guys had to say about that.
Well, it is unusual, but we've had that report before over the years, and it's at the, you know, it's like, well, it's like human births, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, singles are usual, twins are more uncommon, triplets are rare, quads and on up the line are incredibly rare, and it's the same thing with the bears. But four cubs is not unheard of.
Yeah, I kind of wondered if maybe she had picked some up from another sow or something that, you know, maybe had gotten killed or something. But
that's possible, too. But if they were all of similar size and so on, I think it's just unlikely. As likely it was an unusually large litter.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good to see.
So. Oh, you bet. Yeah. Thanks, Rich.
You bet.
Kelly in Middleton, we go to you next. Hi, Kelly.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about porcupines.
Okay.
My husband and I have a cottage on a small lake just north of Madison, and we got up there at noon the other day, and there was a porcupine in our yard in the middle of the day. And I got the dogs in the house so that there wouldn't be problems, but he eventually ambled off. But I was wondering, are they nocturnal? And also my other question is, where do they usually live? Where would he, like, have his little abode?
Well, when you say just north of Madison, how just north of Madison are we talking?
Laval, Reedsburg area.
Hmm. That's actually pretty far south for porkies. I mean, they get down here, but that's in a range where, yes, you could have one, but it's not likely to be they're not likely to be abundant, as you might expect in Vilas or Ashland or Bayfield County or somewhere in the northern part of the state. But your basic questions, even if the animal's there, because it is on the southern part of their range, it may not persist very long. You may have seen it and may never see it again. They are primarily nocturnal, but it's not uncommon to see them out during the day waddling along. And your description of ambling is pretty good. Porcupines don't hurry for anything. They're very slow-moving and deliberate, and usually they have a favored den tree, a hollow tree, log, or whatnot that they will frequent. And it's usually easily identified by a huge pile of porcupine droppings, which look sort of like deer pellets, only several times the size. So if you find the den tree, it'll be readily recognizable. But I have a feeling in that particular area, you might have seen something that was a dispersing, passing through individual, and you may never see it again.
Hmm. Good. I just assume he didn't make up his home there, although my lab definitely wanted to make friends. I told my husband to take the lab out, and I thought maybe he would bark and scare it away, and instead his tail wagged.
Well, scaring it away is a slow proposition because the away part takes a while, but I really think that's not something in that location you need to be too concerned about.
Great. Okay, thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly, for calling. Dory in Sun Prairie, your turn. Hi, Dory.
Hi there. Earlier this week, I was going out of our driveway, which is wooded on both sides, and there was a bird that walked in front of my vehicle, and I have never seen one like it before. It had a pumpkin seed shape, you know, kind of big and round.
Okay.
Almost no tail.
Yeah.
It was dark colored and a very long beak.
Hmm. How big?
Oh, probably about the size of a bigger than a pigeon, about that size.
About
long beak. With a long beak.
Yeah.
When you talk about the pumpkin seed shape pear shape, I was thinking about quail and grouse.
That's what I was thinking too.
Things like that are shaped that way and have a short tail, but they all have very short beaks.
Well, this thing had a long beak and it had almost no tail. And it walked.
Yeah. And what color was it?
It was very dark color. It was in the shade, so you know you couldn't really see. You know, there was no markings that were obvious.
Sounds like a quail or a grouse with a long beak, but
it's not quite
grouse.
Not quite big enough. You know, when you're near other people, there are things like guinea hens and other such things wandering around that would have that shape, but they all have short beaks. Yeah. The long beak suggests some sort of a heron or shorebird or something like that, but I can't think of anything that you'd describe with that with that shape.
Maybe somebody else will have an idea for us.
We'll see what the listeners come up with.
Yeah, because this was odd. I had never seen one like it. And it's wooded, and south of us is, you know, supposed to be wetland.
And this is Sun Prairie area.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you what. We'll think about it ourselves, and maybe some listeners have some ideas as well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, it was kind of a big, you know, tear-shaped, pumpkin seed-shaped.
Okay.
Alrighty.
Thanks a lot for calling. Boy, that's a hard one.
Well, I guess we should have asked what she meant by long bill. That's kind of a relative term. I've got some pheasants around the yard right now that have lost their tails, and as a result, they look kind of like that shape. But most of those birds have a pretty short beak.
Yep. Rosie and Arborvita, your turn. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I had a quick question about ravens, but I just wanted to make a comment first about the jelly and the Orioles. I was sort of cringing when that lady said a 10-ounce feeder, just because I learned either from you, Scott, or another guest on Larry's show that the jelly really should be fresh every day to keep it from spoiling, and it also gets so sticky, even if you just have a little, I have just a little shallow bowl that they feed out of, but it's not good even for the adults to get that sticky stuff on their feet and on their beaks.
Yeah. So, I think there's general agreement that she got some poor advice about the feeder to use. I mean, it's like putting out a 2-pound jar or whatnot with a spoon for them to use. But
yeah, and even
I think
if they
don't
clean mine out, I just dumped a little bit out in the morning every day, and I do notice that it's getting kind of white and gelatinous, so I think there's a good point to that. But I wanted to ask you about if you could just comment on the diet of ravens a little bit. I know they're really great cleaner-uppers when the hawks have had their dinner, and the thing that I am perplexed about that I haven't seen before was I heard a little tiny bunny doing the bunny scream as if something was after it, and I looked out my window, and in a corner there was a raven that was just standing there getting closer and closer and closer and trying to get at the bunny. I thought, well, surely he's not going to, you know, I didn't think they ate live things. And
surprise!
Sure enough, I got him away from there, but being the clever devils that they are, he wasn't going to give up and kept walking around the yard looking for the bunny in the weeds. And I saw him flying off with the bunny in his claws. Mm. And a few days later, I saw him do the same thing with the chipmunk that was alive, and I was just really surprised. A friend of mine had told me she saw a raven carrying a grouse off, and I don't know if she startled the raven. I said, are you sure it wasn't a hawk? And she said, no, it was definitely a raven. And it did drop the grouse, but the grouse had blood on it. And I thought, well, they're not really have the beak to sort of kill them for their babies or however. I just was really surprised about that and wonder if you could talk about, is that a normal behavior for them feeding?
Well, first of all, ravens like crows are consummate scavengers, but given the opportunity to snag something that isn't quite ready to be scavenged yet, they would certainly do that, be it baby bunny, baby bird, frog, snake, or whatever else. I'm a little surprised by the carrying, though, because those birds typically use their beak for anything they're going to lug and really don't have the feet that are adapted to carry anything.
That's what surprised me.
But this raven actually had the rabbit in its feet.
He had it in his feet, and the little guy was curled up and screaming bloody murder, so I knew it was the little bunny, and you could just tell by the way he was curled up, and that was what really surprised me, that he was actually carrying it like a hawk would.
Well, we're going to have to turn to some of our listeners, Larry, because I've never seen any birds in that group using their feet that way.
It's
typically, and I just don't think that they have the strength, foot strength or anything else, to lug a grouse, you know, unless it was a baby one, but that's just too much of a load.
Too much of a weight. So, yeah. Well, she said it was, you know, clear to her that she was close enough, but I don't know. But, I mean, I could see even how he could carry a chipmunk, but even the bunny seemed a little bit much for me. I don't know, maybe he's a weightlifting raven, I'm not sure, but just wanted to see what your take was on that.
My take is that for them to be preying on anything like what you've described is perfectly understandable, and it happens. And a lot of animals, both birds and mammals, will eat things that you don't expect. You know, squirrels taking bird nestlings, people don't expect, but it happens all the time. It's the foot part that bothers me a little bit about this this issue. So we should see if any of our listeners have seen ravens, crows, or birds like that using their feet in that way.
I'd appreciate it.
And if not, then you know, I'm a little concerned that we were actually seeing something else.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I really appreciate your help. Thank you so much.
Yep, thanks, Rosie. And let's go to Betsy in River Falls. Lots of strange things today, Scott. Betsy, hi.
Hi. I'm looking at a picture of an American woodcock, which is kind of a pumpkin seed-shaped bird with a long bill and lives in Wisconsin.
Aha!
So.
Okay, that's a good one.
Merry Christmas.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Betsy. We should have come up with that ourselves.
Wooded area, it is a very rotund bird with a short, stubby tail, and it does have a long beak. I wouldn't have put it at larger than pigeon size, but that's our excuse, and we're sticking with it. But I think woodcock is a pretty safe bet.
I think so, too. Ann in Green Bay, hi to you.
Hi. If I had that previous caller's raven, I wouldn't have to call at all. My question is about, I think, voles with a V, although I'm pretty sure they have friends that look a lot like field mice. They're under my back porch. I live in the suburbs. I'm not real fond of trapping or poisoning. I trapped them last year and ended up naming them Stan and Ollie, and I'm sure they have a lot of children by now. Are they really something that I need to be concerned about?
If they're not causing you a problem, there are many animals in Wisconsin that people get anxious about when they are causing a problem. But in the absence of a problem, I'd argue that any of these animals have redeeming value in terms of becoming named like Stan and Ollie, or just fun to watch in the yard, or otherwise enjoy. So I guess I have to turn it back to you, Ann, and say, if there were a lot of voles in the yard, what could they do? Well, for one thing, during the winter, they may make a mess out of your lawn. And digging little trails and tunnels through the lawn. But that's pretty much cosmetic. If you have a garden, they could be a problem with some of the garden crops. They don't do a whole lot of digging, so I wouldn't be too worried about the foundation or things like that. But voles, which are commonly called meadow mice or field mice, and the long-tailed mice, which would be deer mice or white-footed mice, can reproduce very quickly. And what you really want to be concerned about is the longer-tailed versions will get in the house. The voles won't. And, you know, as I say, if they're not doing something outside that concerns you, I wouldn't be too worried about it. But I would start to get a little concerned in the fall with the voles if you still have what appears to be a high population, because most of the damage they do to landscape plants and woody ornamentals and things happens in the winter, under a protective blanket of snow, when you can't do anything about it. So if you've got a lot of landscaping you might be concerned about, the time to deal with the voles is now, even though they're not causing you the problem now. So it's a proactive step.
Okay, and we have sacrificed some plants to them, and we're okay with that. We don't want to give up the whole yard, but is there a way to deal with them that... I also am not real fond of poisoning. We've had mice in the attic, and I don't even like putting the poison out because we do have a hawk, and I'm always afraid that the hawk is going to encounter something that has eaten some poison. So what?
Well, most of the toxicants or rodenticides that you would be able to purchase as a homeowner have a very low risk of secondary poisoning, which is the problem you described with the hawk.
Good.
So I wouldn't be too worried about that. A high vole or mouse population is very difficult to deal with if you tie one hand behind your back by eliminating poisons and the other hand by eliminating trapping.
Okay.
It's just very difficult to do.
Yeah.
There are certainly some things you can do to protect your trees with hardware cloth or, you know, do some rock covering around in place of mulch and things like that, but it's labor-intensive and time-consuming, and I think you'll find it unsatisfactory. So I would really watch them, and if you start to see a lot of them come fall before snow flies, I'd be out there with my snap traps or bait boxes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, Ann. Thanks for calling.
You know, Larry, I wanted to say on that woodcock identification,
yeah.
I knew immediately it was a woodcock, but I just wanted to see if you'd figure it out. So,
I was waiting the same for you. Let's go to Mike in Holman. Mike, hi.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a a water feature in my front yard that's made out of rock, but not a little crevices, and it's full of algae and stuff. And I have a visitor that I've had for a couple of days, and it's a frog that I have not seen before, and I'm not really familiar with. It is a little bit smaller than a leopard frog, and it is a darkish tan brown, mm-hmm. and it has a very distinctive green that is around its upper lip, mm-hmm. and goes back to approximately where its eardrums or tympanic membrane is, and mm-hmm. then sweeps up slightly, and his underbelly is a whitish, yellowish kind of, and he has a black markings on that that don't appear to be a pattern, but they look like veins, you know, broken veins on his belly.
Uh-huh. Well, it sounds to me like a green frog.
A green frog.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you there are lots of frog booklets and books and ID keys and online and so forth. If you look up green frog, they have their back coloration can be a variety of shades of brown and tan with some blotches on it. But what really gives them away is that bright green lip going back to the tympanum, the eardrum that you described. Huh? So they're not easy sometimes to tell from a juvenile bullfrog, except the fact that the green frogs are far more common and tend to get around the countryside a little better. So if you happen to hear it call, if it happens to call or make a sound, it's going to sound like a single loose banjo string note. And it's very distinctive once you've heard it a couple of times. But I think without the spots of the leopard frog or pickerel frog, and without the shape and toes of the tree frogs, it's a green frog.
Is it, and that is a common frog in Wisconsin?
Very common frog.
Yep.
Now, further north, there's one other one that's a little smaller called a mink frog that, in boggy areas might be a possibility, but I think just on the basis of numbers, we're probably talking green frog. And they can be quite. Yeah. I had them reach my water feature a few years ago in a wetter season, and they can become quite tame. We got it to the point where you could actually go out with angle worms and kind of dangle them down. The frogs would just sit there and take the worms. So it's a good frog to have around.
And suns himself, and mm-hmm. then when you get a little too close, he gets back in the crevice. And,
mm-hmm. yeah.
But very pretty. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. Renee in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Renee.
Hi. I had a comment on the raven crow situation. I lived in town about 10, 12 years ago, when my son and I were outside, and we heard this baby rabbit screaming and screaming and screaming, and we couldn't figure out where it was coming, and we looked up in the sky, and there was a crow flying overhead with a baby rabbit in his claws, and he dropped it in our yard. And we tried to save it, but it subsequently died.
Yeah.
So
the evidence seems to be building that they will use their feet for that purpose. But
yeah.
I'm going to have to check up on that a little bit.
I was so surprised.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thanks, Renee.
Yeah. Thanks. Bye. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that's a little baffling. I mean, I can think of hundreds of occasions where I've seen a crow carrying an egg or a chipmunk or a nestling or something, but in its beak.
Yeah. Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking Wisconsin Wildlife with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Dolores in Mount Sterling, Illinois has a question for you, Scott. Hi, Dolores.
Hi. I was wondering, we have had sat feeders up for about, maybe 20, 25 years now. And this summer, instead of just getting the regular woodpeckers and nuthatches and things in, the sparrows and the blue jays are eating at the fat feeder.
So suet blocks.
You mean. Suet blocks,
okay.
Right.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Now, I've never seen it before. Do they ordinarily eat at a suet block?
It depends a little bit on what you're using. If you're using straight suet, it would be more likely that you'd restrict that to nuthatches, woodpeckers, and the like. But when you start to use the seed mix blocks, which I was just feeding at a little square suet block holder while I was in northern Wisconsin, I finally quit because the blackbirds and the blue jays,
the grackles,
and some of the sparrows and the grackles would come in and land on that feeder and spin it around and throw suet every which way. And the window was so covered with little pieces of grease and seeds that I got sick of cleaning it and quit. So, yes, those birds will go after the seed cakes, and I think perhaps they're catching on that those seed cakes are a good source of food.
There's a way to deal with that, depending on the feeder. We have a feeder that's it's sort of on a platform. If you put the seed cake on the floor, on the underside of the floor, the only birds that will come then to feed on it will be the woodpeckers and so forth.
Because they don't mind hanging upside down.
They don't mind hanging upside down.
And can grab hold of it.
Okay, maybe we'll have to change what we're doing.
Well,
it's worth a try.
But, now, you know, I've never seen it before. That's why I was curious about it.
I've had a lot of that this summer myself. And I just was at a bird store. The reason I know this, I was at a bird store and they were advertising it. And it's just the way mounted underneath and your problems will go away.
Okie doke. We'll have to change the way we're doing it.
Okay.
So I wonder, it seems like you could just beat the hanging little square mesh feeders or suet feeders if you just got, a 1 foot square piece of plywood with an eye bolt in the middle of it and mounted your little suet holder on the bottom of that.
Mm-hmm.
And that should eliminate the larger birds.
Yep.
Well, there you go.
Thanks, Dolores. Chad in Cataract, your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question. I shot a rabbit the other day, and when I walked up to it, there was a hole in its belly, and I thought that was where I shot it, but there was something black kind of inside of it. And so I squeezed on it, and it was kind of pussy, and out popped this big, giant, inch-and-a-half-long, grayish grub. Or not grub, it was kind of like a cocoon or pupa. It was wriggling and writhing about. It was like inch-and-a-half-long, three-quarters of an inch fat, and squirming all around, and it was in the rabbit. I just don't know what kind of parasite that is.
Well, I think it was probably a bot fly larva.
Hmm.
If you check that online or look up bot fly, they can be quite large and quite disgusting. And I'm guessing now that quite a few of our listeners won't be having lunch today after that description. but nevertheless, check out something called a bot fly, B-O-T, and I think you'll see what you found.
All right. Thanks for calling. Paul and Nina, on to you.
Yes, hi. A question for you. I knew that was a woodcock, too, by the way, right away when I heard that.
didn't we all?
yeah. Very tough bird to hunt as well. I have this loud buzzing coming from my trees all the time, and I know people have argued with me, oh, it's a tree frog. No, it's this. No, it's that. What is that? It sounds like a power line humming almost, very loud pitch.
Those are any one of several types of insects that Phil Pelletieri can expound on at great length. It's probably not a tree frog, and especially with the way things are going with the weather this year, the tree frogs that by this time of year on a humid night are plastered all over the end of my garage near the security light have just vanished, gone, disappeared. So there are some called snowy tree crickets. There are a whole variety. Well, I shouldn't say that many, but there are a number of different insects that will make that incessant buzzing sound and will go most of the night. But it's an insect, not a frog.
Yeah, it's usually right before dark, and it's very loud.
And you can look around, and you just can't see anything, and you wonder, what the heck is that? But when I've actually caught the snowy tree crickets, they're a pretty good-sized insect, kind of a lime green in color, but they blend in with the foliage so well.
Okay.
It's just very unlikely you're going to get a hold of them.
Yeah, I never see them either, so interesting. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Paul. Kathy in Monona, it's your turn. Hi, Kath.
Good afternoon. How are you doing?
Great.
At the top of the hour, you were talking about squirrels being different colors.
Yes.
Well, I live here in Monona, and we've had tons of squirrels my whole life growing up. But I had to take a picture of this one. Here's this little guy. If he were to stand up on his back legs, from the waist up in a perfect straight line, he is a brownish-gray traditional type of color for a squirrel. And from the waist down,
he is
totally blonde.
Blonde. Okay, well, could be blonde, could be black, but for whatever reason, and I really need to spend a little time trying to sort this out with a geneticist. Normally, the party line on gray squirrels was that they came in three basic color phases. Either normal gray, which everybody sees all the time, jet black, the melanistic alternative, or a golden yellow phase, which you saw half of, that is commonly called a Lady Isabella squirrel, kind of a blonde color, very pretty animal. But generally speaking, the thinking was that they were one or the other, and that was kind of it, gray, black, blonde.
Yes.
Now, more recently, and especially this year, I've had a rash of photographs. Of course, it's easier to send photographs now electronically than it ever was before.
Yeah.
But I would guess in the last 2 months, I've had half a dozen people send wonderful photographs, including one exactly what you just described, except the squirrel was brown on the back end, and it looked like someone had held it by the tail and dipped it in a bucket of black paint.
Exactly.
It was jet black on one end, brown on the other. You had the reverse. But one of the outdoor writers for the local papers, Jerry Davis, apparently had an article and some pictures of some of these oddly colored squirrels just within the past couple of weeks, which generated another rash of photographs.
Yeah.
But for whatever reason, they seem to be coming in mixed, you know, blonde with a black tail, black with a blonde tail, brown with a darker brown tail, and all sorts of permutations and combinations in between. And I have no explanation for what's going on except to share your observation that there have been some really strange ones around this year.
And we have seen a blonde one running around totally blonde, and of course the general brown. But to have this perfect line totally around the torso and up over the back, it's just so unusual.
Yep.
Yes.
So it's not too unusual this year.
Not this year. But I'm going to talk to the folks in the Zoology Museum, and where they have many specimens going back through the years, to check out and see if I can get to the bottom of this. And I'll report back to Larry so he can pass it on to the listeners.
And another thing, a lot of the squirrels just don't have the tails that they used to, you know, the big puffy fat ones. You know, they're kind of skinny and not very full. I don't know what's going on with that.
Part of that may be just the time of year. I mean, many of these animals simply are in their summer pellage and don't want, the last thing a squirrel needs right now is a gigantic bushy tail to lug around in this heat.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Gaff. Tom in Stevens Point, we will turn to you next. Hi, Tom.
Good morning. First of all, I want to thank you for working on the 4th of July. I was stranded by a 4th of July parade in Lafarge, and the good thing was that I got to watch the parade and listen to you guys on the radio for an hour.
Well, great.
My question is about bears. A couple years ago, I was riding my bike on a state trail, and I thought I saw a bear cross the trail in front of me, and I decided I'd gone far enough and turned back. But what should you do if you come upon a bear or startle a bear? Like, usually would happen to me while I'm riding my bike, if it were to happen.
If you're on a bike, you know, bears aren't that fleet of foot, and the risk of a bear pursuing somebody is just, it's just infinitesimally small. So I think the first thing to do, Tom, is not fall off your bike when you're startled in the presence of the bear. As long as you can maintain your composure and keep on riding, I think the bear's going to be primarily interested in keeping as much distance between you and he or she as is possible. There's just, bears are doing very well. They're expanding their range in Wisconsin. There are lots of human bear encounters, and we just don't hear much about.
So, like, if a bear is eating some berries off to the side of the trail, just keep on going past.
Well, I wouldn't press the issue.
Okay.
If you can give it a wide berth.
Okay.
Or back off and enjoy watching it for a few minutes until it moves further away.
Okay.
I'd certainly do that rather than trying to zoom by it on the bike and give it a swift kick in the butt. So I think a little common sense here goes a long way, and it's a matter of not pressing the issue. But generally speaking, the numbers of bears we have now, and of course the numbers of people and the distribution of people, suggests that people are going to encounter them more and more frequently. And fortunately, other than the occasional incident you may hear about at a campground where someone's been grabbed, and there have been some cases in Wisconsin, that's by far and away the exception rather than the rule.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I remember I was playing in a golf tournament in Saskatchewan in one of their provincial parks, and there was a black bear with two cubs, and the guy I was with said, well, don't hit down that side of the fairway because the bear's right there along the edge. And, of course, that's exactly where I wound up hitting. And then my next shot, you know, the bear was about 100 yards away. I hit, tried to hit to the right, and instead I hit a screaming low line drive right toward, right at the bear, and the ball cleared the bear's head by about 2 inches. And I went the kind of the other direction. We made a, still the bear didn't, the bear's head came up, and it was wondering what just
what was that.
But the bear, even the bear with cubs, that I certainly didn't get between the bear and their cubs, but we made a wide circle and everybody was fine. Tom in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I just wanted to share a story because I was listening about the ravens and the rabbits. And there was on the north side of Milwaukee, if anyone knows, Sherman Boulevard is a pretty fast-moving road, and it's just north of Good Hope along a long cemetery. And middle of the day, I came upon all these baby rabbits out in the road. And I thought, inevitably, they're going to get squished by cars because it's just too fast-moving. And so I stopped, pulled over on the curb in a safe spot, ran back, and there's this huge raven swooping down and trying to pick up one of the little baby rabbits. And so I'm trying to gather up the rabbits, get them up off the street onto the boulevard on the side. And during that time, and there, one of them's hiding in a soda cup on the side of the road, you know, and others are just scampering back and forth, and they can't jump the curb and get back onto the grass. And so the raven's swooping, and then this mother rabbit appears and bounds out into the roadway and stands on its hind legs and is trying to fend off this raven. And I'm watching all of this while trying to gather up these babies. And the raven did succeed in picking up one of the babies and flew over the cyclone fence into the cemetery.
You know what? We're going to have to continue this story.
It's high noon.
Stay with us on the Ideas Network. Talking the wonderful world of Wisconsin wildlife now with Scott Craven, UW Extension Wildlife Ecologist. Thanks for listening in. Give us a call if you have a question at 1-800-642-1234 or in Madison at 263-1890. And Scott, before we get back to other conversations, I did want to mention the deadlines that are approaching for hunting licenses and so forth. Or for hunting itself,
There are a variety of them throughout the year, but one big one has, it's not approaching, it's here.
It's here,
August 1st, today, is the application deadline for fall turkeys and geese and several other types of permits. So if you're thinking about participating in some fall hunting opportunity, you better check things out today and either get to a licensed vendor or go on to the DNR website and get those permit applications in, or there are some opportunities you'll simply miss out on.
And we had a caller who had wondered about, or was telling a story about a raven, supposedly, that attacked some baby rabbits, and then the mother came out to defend the raven. That sounds, I have not heard of baby or of mother rabbits actually defending their young.
Well, they're not the best parents, and they occupy the unenviable position of being at the bottom of the food chain when it comes to animal life. So just about everything out there, from foxes and other mammalian predators on up to hawks and owls and ravens and so forth, is just very thrilled about dining on rabbit. So all the calls we've had about crows and ravens and assorted other things taking rabbits, is nothing at all surprising about that. And we'll look into this foot issue in terms of whether they're carrying them with their feet or bills. The issue of the female rabbit being protective, you know, females of most species will at least try and make something of a stand, but the rabbit just doesn't have the tools to do a whole lot. So I don't know what to make of that. It was an interesting story.
Interesting
story.
Yeah, that's for sure. Ray in Merrimack, it's your turn. Hi, Ray.
Good morning, gentlemen.
Hi.
Scott, I've been interested in the black squirrel, these black gray squirrels, for a long time, since I came to this part of the country in 1965. I recently talked to a couple of friends of mine, both biologists, retired biology teachers down at Whitewater. One had a specialty of genetics, and there was no question in his mind that this is a process called industrial melanization. And what that means is that the forests themselves have become darker, and the bark of the trees have become darker over the years. And because of that, in natural selection, the squirrels that are darker are the ones who are more likely to thrive.
Well, I think that goes back to a classic story in genetics where moths became darker because of that notion of soot and so forth on trees. But, the black squirrel issue is one of it is a genetic issue, a melanistic condition, kind of the opposite of albinism. But I find it a real stretch to think that the industrial melanization has anything to do with it, since it's so widespread. And in fact, the most abundant or widest distribution of black squirrels that I see anywhere in the state is in the middle of Northwoods, the Northwoods where I was at Kemp Station, where the industrialization issue should not be a factor.
Interesting.
So, there's something going on with squirrel coloration, but I think it's a real stretch to think it's related to our infrastructure in the country.
Yeah, interesting. Thanks for calling, Ray. Appreciate it. Let's go to Al in Bayfield next. Hi, Al.
Yeah, good morning. I was hoping Scott could help identify some little animals that I saw a couple weeks ago. I was biking on a trail along Lake Superior, and up ahead of me I saw some spots that I thought were maybe pieces of wood or something, and as I got closer, I realized it was animals, and it was four of them, and they were like four buddies walking down the trail on all fours. And as I got closer, three of them scattered, but the fourth one stayed on a little limb right next to the trail, and we stood there looking at each other for a couple of minutes at least. He didn't move. I didn't move. I didn't have a camera so I could take a picture of him. But I couldn't figure out what they were. They were about the size of a cat. They had dark fur, and their face looked just like the face of a baby bear.
Well, I think what you saw were young fishers, actually. A fisher face looks very much bear-like. They have very dark fur. They're very much cat-like in shape and size, and they spend a bit of time off the ground, so the fact that it was on a limb or sitting there looking at you doesn't surprise me very much. So I think if you go to Field Guide or Key and check out a fisher, I think you'll find that that's what you saw.
Okay.
So the fur was dark. Okay. Now, yeah. There's another musteleod or weasel family member in the Northwoods, the pine marten, which has the same type of face, but they're generally much more of a blonde or brown color.
Okay.
So. Mm-hmm.
And fishers are pretty aggressive, aren't they?
Yeah, they get blamed for everything from eating everybody's pets to poor TV reception, but they will dine on virtually anything they can find, but I wouldn't necessarily describe them as aggressive toward people.
Okay.
All right,
thank you. Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot for calling. And on to Gigi in Viroqua. Hi to you. Thanks for calling.
Hi. In our neighborhood is a very large, friendly rabbit. I have a 9-pound dog, a little toy, and the rabbit looks bigger and rounder than the dog. And I've never had a rabbit. I don't know where it escaped from. I don't know what to do with it. Will it live through the winter on its own? Can you give me some clues?
Well, if it's that big, it's not a domestic rabbit. Not a wild rabbit. But certainly after going, 2 weekends ago to the Dane County Fair and walking through the rabbit barn and seeing all manner of rabbits in terms of size, shape, and color, some of the big Flemish hares can get up to 15 pounds or more. So they're quite sizable animals. So what you're describing sounds to me like someone's pet or a captive animal that's either been released inadvertently or intentionally, and is probably fine for the warm season, but winter might be a problem for it. But I suspect long before that, something else by way of dog, cat, or wild predator is probably going to dine on it. And there's probably, short of trying to capture it, and making a positive identification with some rabbit fancier as to what you have, and then returning it to captivity, whether you want to keep it or not, or whether you deal with Humane Society or whatever, I don't think there's much else you can do.
All right.
But it certainly, with that size description, it certainly doesn't sound like a wild rabbit.
No, it sure doesn't.
One little extra question. How do we catch it? What kind of...
Well, there are many good brands of wire box traps or live traps, and you'd simply, if you spend a little time figuring out where the animal spends its time or where it comes and goes under a fence or around a corner or under a bush or whatever, and then take one of these suitably sized live traps and bait it with fresh green beans, sliced carrot, sliced apple, or a smorgasbord of vegetables like that, and position it strategically, and you're likely to get the rabbit.
Yep, very likely. And
a tomahawk live traps are made right here in Wisconsin. They're very good. There are lots of brands, but set it properly according to the instructions, bait it, and be patient, and be prepared to release who knows how many coons or wild rabbits before you actually get the one you want. But that's really the only thing I could suggest.
Yeah, I guess I wouldn't leave the trap open in the evening after dark, because that's when you'll catch the raccoons. If you want the rabbit, I think you're better off to have it run during the daytime. At least that's been my experience, anyway.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks for calling. Sandra in Milwaukee, hi to you.
Hello. I'm calling about a toad migration. Mm-hmm. Several years ago, in the middle of August, on a foggy, drizzly night, about midnight, I took my dog out, and we saw hundreds, probably thousands, of middle-sized toads, not the little tiny toadlets, but at least medium size, crossing the road. They were traveling from east to west. They had crossed 2 6-lane roads and were very intent on wherever they were going. There were so many of them, and I've been wondering ever since, where did they come from? Where are they going? Why?
All right. Well, I'll tell you what, Scott probably has the exact answer for that.
Well, maybe not. Typically, this time of year, as the wetlands are drying up, as we discussed earlier, and this is when the salamanders and frogs of all types, including toads, metamorphose from tadpoles into the toadlets the caller described, and then, boom, on a suitable night, especially it was a dark and foggy night. That would be a good way to start a book. But anyway, on a suitable night, and they need the moisture, they leave the breeding ponds and scatter all over the place. And we've had lots of accounts of people's window wells filling up and the patios covered with toads, and there's toads everywhere. But that's more of a haphazard movement, and it involves smaller toads than what Sandra's describing here. But I can imagine a circumstance, given weather conditions, when the toadlets emerged, and they grow very quickly once they emerge, and were perhaps confined to the area of the breeding pond, even though they had emerged, by weather conditions not suitable to make any kind of a movement over land. And at some point, the weather, this foggy, gloomy night appeared. The toadlets had now grown beyond the normal dispersal size of about the size of your little fingernail, and all of a sudden, they're headed out. And the directional movement would all be of the animals moving from the breeding pond, you know, back on the landscape. Had Sandra been on the other side of the breeding pond, they all might have been moving in a different direction. But the point is they're moving out concentrically from whatever the breeding source was. And short of that explanation, which is a little bit hypothetical, I can think of no other. Toads don't coordinate their activity. There's really no such thing in my experience of a herd of toads with any kind of herd behavior like you'd expect a flock of birds to move in unison. So whatever was observed here, I think, was related to environmental conditions at the time. And the toads were all out on a very favorable night for toads.
And at midnight, that's probably a favorable time for crossing the roads, too.
Yes.
Thanks, Sandra.
Well, thank you very much. I was noticing the traffic, and fortunately there were not many cars passing by, and I didn't actually see any get squished, but it's a miracle.
Yeah, it is indeed. Thanks again. Megan in Hales Corners, your turn. Hi, Megan.
Hi, how are you?
Good.
I have I've been stumped on this. I just recently moved up from Northern Illinois. I live in Lake Villa, and I travel back and forth to Brookfield. I take the back roads because it's just an easy route, and every day I see these two things on the side of the road in the field feeding, and at one point I saw four, but at first I thought they were deer, and then I looked a little closer, and they're birds. They're brown, mm-hmm. and they have like a reddish beak. They look like some type of crane.
They're probably sandhill cranes.
Sandhill cranes, almost for sure.
They're almost as big as a deer. They're routinely out in open agricultural fields. The young ones are brownish. The adults are more gray. They have a little red top knot and a big bill. I don't think there's any doubt that what you saw were cranes.
Well, thank you very much, because I've been stumped, and no one knows what I'm talking about. They think I'm crazy.
No.
But I can't get over. No one slows down. No one notices them, and I think they're beautiful. So
sandhill
really
cranes.
Nice, something new. Great.
Wait till you hear them call.
Yeah, I haven't heard that yet. But it's something to look forward to, I guess.
There you go.
It is. Thanks, Megan.
Thank you.
And they really are great to hear call. Matt in Menominee, hello to you.
Hi. I was calling about that... that raven?
Yep. Yeah.
I just wanted to say that I thought that was probably more likely to be a melanistic red tail. It sounds much more, I've been a falconer for about 5-6 years now, and that sounds a lot more like what they would be doing.
Well, it did to me too, Matt, whether it was a melanistic red tail or a dark phase rough leg or some mm-hmm. other large dark raptor.
Yeah.
Which would have behaved much more like what was described. I don't know where you stand on the raven using their foot notion. But
no, I can't imagine them ever being able to carry anything as large as a rabbit or a grouse.
Well, I can't either. And I thought crows and I've got to go back to my bird book, but I thought they were perching birds.
Yeah, they are.
And just don't have the foot structure or strength to carry things like that. But
no, they're pretty tiny.
We'll see if anybody else weighs in on this. But thanks, right. Thanks for your thanks. Suggestion.
Bye. Yeah, bye. Thanks, Matt. That's a good guess there, I think. Reed in Clintonville, your turn. Hi, Reed.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Hi.
Say, on Megan's behalf, I would recommend that she just, if it's safe, pull over on the side of the road, roll down her window, and I'll bet she'd hear those cranes. We have a huge flyway here in Clintonville,
mm-hmm.
and they're absolutely wonderful, and they just sort of strut away if you get out of the car to take a picture, but they slowly strut away, and boy, you hear them clucking. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and the calls, it sounds kind of prehistoric to me.
It sure is. Yes. Well, they're
neat.
A prehistoric bird.
Mm-hmm.
My question actually has to do with turtles. So recently, now I've seen a number of turtles, no snappers, but other turtles, you know, like box or a painted, I guess, or what. Crossing the road, and I know that it's too late for them to be laying eggs, I would think. And I've at least gotten out of the car and moved them to the other side in the direction they were going, but always wanting to take them to a safer place. And my wife says, oh, no, because they're very territorial and don't move them. And maybe you can fill us in on some of those things, like, for instance, if they are laying a second clutch of eggs and territory, et cetera.
Well, first of all, in terms of turtles being out and about, the party line is that the nesting season is usually early June to
right.
mid to late June. But it was late this year for whatever reason, and it should be over with by now, but it was noticeably later than normal. And since with all wild events, there's kind of a bell curve of distribution, you know, some early, some late, most are at a given time. It's still quite possible that a few individuals might be out there later than normal looking for a nesting site. But in a lot of the state right now, we've had some pretty dry conditions. I think another explanation for them being out and about is that the pond or slough or ditch pond or whatever that they were utilizing has simply dried up, and they're heading for new territory. So those are two possible explanations. But either way, I think in terms of moving the turtles, Generally, they know where they are and they know where to go to find water. So helping them across the road is a matter of moving them across the road in the direction they were headed and then assuming that they were doing okay. If you know that they're headed in the direction, if for example, they're dispersing from a dried-up wetland and there's just nothing for a mile or more in the direction they're headed, you know, then relocating them to the nearest source of permanent water is probably not. It's okay.
It's okay to do.
But generally speaking, I think they're going to be okay on their own if you can all just right. help them avoid traffic.
Well, mm-hmm. thanks very much.
Okay.
Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Scott, I know we've talked a lot about bird sounds and animal sounds and cries and so forth, and I know you kind of wanted to give our listeners a chance to hear a couple of interesting sounds.
Well, that one's from the Guide to Wildlife Sounds, that CD that you have. We've used this in the past, and there were just a couple I picked out if you want to give them a shot. One was chipmunk, because this has been, not only have there been weird colored squirrels, but it's been an incredible year for the abundance of red squirrels and chipmunks and probably other small mammals. And a chipmunk call sounds very bird-like and is often misidentified as a bird. So that was one. And the other one was just a bird I came to really enjoy up in the North Woods singing just at dark, and that's a wood thrush, which is one of the prettiest bird calls or bird songs, in my opinion. So if we could get those up, that'd be great. Good way
to listen to that chipmunk. Yeah, let's listen.
Hi, friends. This is Lang Elliott of Nature Sound Studio.
Well, there's the
welcome
lead
to
for
a
this.
Guide to Wildlife Sounds. Let's begin. Eastern chipmunk.
There we go.
Boy, that sounds...
And that's that chirping sound that sounds, I think, for most people not familiar with what they're listening to, they just wouldn't identify that as a mammal. And then if we can get the wood thrush up, it's just a pretty bird song.
Let's try the wood thrush.
Wood thrush.
Hmm. It carries for a long way in the woods. It occurs just at dark when there's not much else singing, and it's just very distinctive and nice.
I wanted to get those two in before we forgot about it. And Carolyn Grafton has a question for us, so let's go to Carol. Hi, Carol.
Hi. I was fishing with my daughters in Limekiln Park in Grafton a week or so ago, and we saw a little animal, looked about the size of a cat, came down to the river, swam across, ran along the opposite bank, and then went up a tree. And we came home and looked on the internet, and we thought it might be a weasel. But we were wondering, do weasels, you know, come in this area of the state?
What county are we talking
about? Ozaukee County.
Hmm. Well, there are certainly weasels, but generally speaking, they're not the best of climbers. Was this a long, slender animal?
Yes, it was. At first we thought it was a cat, but then we saw it jump in the water. And we thought, well, maybe it's a small dog, but then it climbed up the tree.
Well, it sounds to me like, especially the water, it sounds like a mink. And,
yeah.
You know, they can climb a bit, but not strong climbers. But certainly with the water, the long, slender animal, the setting, a mink is a good bet.
Uh-huh, and that's an animal that's typical around the Ozaukee County area?
They're widely distributed throughout the state.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you. That's really interesting.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I see from the Department of Natural Resources now, there were some emergency rules on the VHS, which have now been made permanent. So the DNR has got some permanent rules on VHS. So if you're fishing and all that and using the waters, even not fishing, but just using the waters, it's good to pay attention to those.
Transporting fish and bait and so forth is a new deal.
Yeah. Thanks a lot, Scott. Appreciate your being with us, and we will look forward to your next visit, which will be the first Wednesday of September. Oh, my goodness.
Summer is disappearing,
but we are not. Scott will be back the first Wednesday of next month, and we'll do this all over again with him. Just to let you know, coming up tomorrow at 11, Janet Jenkins, administrator of the Department of Trade and Consumer Protection, and David Tater of the State Office of Privacy Protection will be our guest at 11. And then at 11:45, some more outdoors with Gary Engberg of Maize and Maney. He'll talk about his enthusiasm for fishing in the outdoors. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.